Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Well, hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Bookshelf Conversation. Sorry it's been a while and so haphazard and slipshod. Trying to find a rhythm here and hope we'll be able to bring these things to you on a more regular basis. Today we're going to be talking with Todd Radom, a graphic designer who specializes in branding for professional sports franchises. He's compiled an entertaining collection and deconstruction of some of the greatest, worst, and most unusual baseball attire in his recent book, Winning Ugly, A Visual History of the Most Bizarre Baseball Uniforms Ever Worn. Here's our conversation with Todd. Todd Radom, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Ron. It's great to be here.
So this is a very fun book. I mean, it is about uniforms, so it's going to be very nicely illustrated. But tell us how you came up with the idea for this.
Well, you know, the genesis of the idea really lies in the fact that the New York Times came to me last spring to write an opinion piece about kind of the joys of ugly uniforms. And it's a very subjective topic, of course, but, you know, as I say in the book, baseball is a game that lends itself to introspection. The season is very long. The games are sort of deliberate, and we tend to focus on the uniforms, whether you're a fashion maven or a design aficionado or what have you. So that was that's where the whole thing got started. And my background revolves around the fact that I have been kind of observing the visual culture of sports for as long as I can remember, back since I was a kid. And I am a designer and a brand consultant, and I've worked in professional sports for 25 years now.
So you say brand consultant, so that's one of the questions I had. Have you worked on with any teams in the design of their uniforms?
My work has been on the uniforms of every team in the major leagues.
Wow.
At one point or another.
Wow.
Yep. Over the last 25 years, I've designed several. This is my world right here.
So I
come
be
at
careful.
It from a very opinion. Well, I come at it from a very opinionated opinion. So you don't have to be careful. Dive right in. Because it's probably not my work.
Oh, okay. So I'm hoping then that your work was not the camouflage uniform that is coming to vogue. I mean, I understand the symbolism behind it, and I'm all about the veterans, but I think camouflage uniforms are hideous. And,
yeah.
And I don't think I'm alone in that opinion.
No, I would tend to agree with you. The thing, of course, originated with the San Diego Padres, mm-hmm. And San Diego is such a strong Navy community. It really is part of their DNA. But when it spread to New York, for instance, and the Mets started wearing camo, and, you know, camo kind of spread like wildfire, it certainly diluted the power of the message of supporting veterans. And, yeah, it's not the best of look, but I think if anybody can get away with it, it's the San Diego Padres because of the fact that they had it first and because of the dynamics of that particular city and market.
Now, I'm sure not the only one to think that teams are changing their uniforms with increasing frequency in recent years, and the cynic in me thinks it's a ploy to sell stuff to the fans. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, that is part of it. You do have to consider the fact that if a team puts out pick the Brewers or the Diamondbacks, clubs with lots of different looks, they only derive 1/30th of the revenue from that because it's shared among all the clubs. Mm. So I don't think that's the driver. I do think that the driver of these, you know, it's what I would term the Oregon duckization, to coin a phrase, of sports uniforms. The Oregon Ducks, famously starting about a dozen, 15 years ago, something like that, started literally trotting out a different uniform every game of the college football season. And we now are in a place where Nike in the NBA, every team has four different uniforms. They have totally thrown out the designations of home and road. And when you really think about it, this phenomenon sort of tracks society. And I talk about this all the time. It's perfect for our collectively diminished attention spans. We sit there clicking and scrolling. Uh-huh. And so, you know, it only makes sense where brand impressions are so fleeting and we're bombarded by imagery 24/7. Doesn't it make sense that this, you know, infiltrates our uniform culture?
So talk about the process of when a team comes to you and says, what do they say to you when they approach you for a job?
Well, I mean, every job and every sport is different, and, you know, professional franchises, regardless of sport, generally make a change for a couple of very defined reasons. Number one, it's because there's some new ownership that wants to impart a new look onto their new billion-dollar toy. Or number two, it's to break a cycle of losing, a down era, throw the visuals out with the bathwater, this kind of a thing. And then there are, you know, what I would say, there are teardowns along those lines, and then there are evolutions. A good example of an evolution would be, and I had nothing to do with that, but the what the Toronto Blue Jays did several years ago in kind of reaching back into their past, to their DNA, to update their original look and make it a little more relevant for the 21st century. So every job is a little bit different. You need to really know why this kind of change is being made in order to execute it successfully. And when you think about it, changes like this go beyond well beyond a logo and a uniform, because it can really have huge ramifications in terms of decorating an entire stadium, which could be a multi-million-dollar, multi-year process. Mm-hmm. And, of course, thinking about this stuff, how it looks digitally, what it's going to look like on product, what it's going to look like on broadcast, motion graphics, the fact that these things break apart and move. It's very, very different than it was when I first started doing this back in the early 90s.
Yeah, you say that, it makes me think of New Coke.
Well, New Coke, of course, famously was a marketing disaster, and I always say this, you know, sports fans are the most ardent brand loyalists on earth. If you were not so happy about New Coke, well, you know, you could go to something else and it's not going to wreck your life. But if you really hate what happened to the graphics or the uniforms of your favorite team, you're most likely going to stick with them regardless of how bad they might look to you.
Now, you've got a chapter, and I think this began in the 80s, where you talk about racing stripes. Now, I'm just wondering, why? I mean, it seems like such a tiny detail. So I'm wondering why teams would go to the trouble of adding that to their uniforms. What purpose does it serve? Especially, you know, the Mets had pinstripes. Other teams had pinstripes. You know, what does that thicker racing stripe impart to a team's visual psyche?
Well, if you think about it, back when those were introduced, our trim on our uniforms was really much chunkier than it is today, right? Teams had these gigantic bands of, you know, of one-inch stripes on their sleeves, mm-hmm. and big stripes that went down the side. So really, the racing stripes only served to increase that. It was, in that case, really a little bit of an evolution there, too, rather than a revolution. I think it was meant to, certainly in the case of the Expos, which I talk about in the book, kind of denote speed and streamlining. There's a tradition of this sort of thing in general graphic design and product design. Raymond Loewy, who is a famous product designer, designed locomotives, very sleek, streamlined lines, smooth lines, and this is what happened on our baseball uniforms with those teams that did go to the racing stripes. To your point, the Mets with their pinstripes sort of created a little bit of an odd effect. The Mets were, you know, were weird outliers because they had pullovers, but they still wore belts, this kind of a thing. But it was, as I say, kind of a fleeting phenomenon that hung on until the mid 90s for a little bit.
Now you hear about back in the day when the teams wore flannel and how horribly hot it was to wear flannel, and then it evolved into double knit polyester. What's the material of choice these days?
Well, these days, I mean, it really is incredible because you pick up an actual game jersey today, and it's, you know, I can't quantify, but it's incredibly lighter than what teams were wearing 6-7 years ago, and those in turn are so much lighter than the old double knits that kind of from the 70s up until the mid 90s. You know, there's a mesh aspect to it now, whereas those things were pretty bulletproof. Those original double knit jerseys from the early 70s are really just, you know, yes, they were an improvement over the flannels in certain respects, but man, those things are just amazingly, amazingly thick. And the twill lettering on them added a lot of weight. Nowadays, it's all about performance. It's sort of like this arms race between the manufacturers to go lighter, and, you know, it's part of their marketing. But they really are just, it's got to be far more comfortable than they used to be.
Speaking of marketing, what are your thoughts on the idea of putting sponsor logos on uniforms?
When you say sponsor logos, do you mean the equivalent of Coke or Pepsi, or
yeah,
the manufacturer's logo?
No, the manufacturer, well, expects them to be there. But as far as like, you know, because anytime you turn in the game, no matter, every single event in this game is brought to you by, you know, some pipe fitting company or some, you know, grass cutting company. Everything is sponsored. So I'm just wondering about that.
Yeah, there's our bombardment of imagery and of advertising. So I think a couple of things. I think number one, anytime you put a logo next to another logo, they serve to chip away at one another. So if you put think about, again, going back to what the NBA has done, because they really, this year in putting sponsorship on their uniforms, you know, they have pioneered the Big Four here in the U.S. for better or for worse. If you are, Goodyear, and you're advertising on the Cleveland Cavaliers uniform, well, the impression of a Goodyear logo, again, it chips away at the Cavs a little bit. It can really, you could turn this around to the point that you see in soccer, for instance, or in the WNBA, where the roles are reversed. The team logo is subjugated to this tiny little place. So I don't think it's a good thing. I think it's got to be handled very delicately. There are obviously financial benefits to the franchises,
sure,
that, you know, they're not going to go leaving money on the table. And I think that the way that the NBA handles it is probably the most sensible. The sponsor logo is relegated to the same place on every team's uniform. It has to be a certain size and dimension, and it is a clear number two compared to the team brand. But this is where we're going. I don't think there's any turning back.
You know, there's something to be said about tradition. I'm thinking about the Yankee pinstripes. And the Yankee pinstripes, I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, were designed that way to make Babe Ruth look slimmer. And
apocryphal! Total fallacy! The Yankees started wearing pinstripes in 1912 when Babe Ruth was, you know, hitting balls over the fence at St. Mary's for the good brothers there. Brother Matthias. So, yes, it's apocryphal. He joined the pinstripes. But, listen, the Yankee pinstripes, to your point, they are the Brooks Brothers suit, the Wall Street look of Major League Baseball. And excellence had a lot to do with that.
And that's what bothers me no end when I see them tinkering with, and again, this is for the fans, they're coming out with pink Yankee hats for whoever wants to wear pink. You know, I'm not going to generalize, but, you know, there's something, I'm a boomer, I'm a traditionalist, I'm not a dinosaur, you know, I think, you know, some change is good, but I also think there's some things that are sacrosanct and you don't mess with them, but again, that's just me. Because,
well, I think that you gotta, you separate, I at least separate the two things. I think that, you know, it's like Field of Dreams. Once you cross the white lines and you are on the field of play, that's a little bit more of a sacred space. What happens in the stands is, you know, anything goes.
Yeah.
The pink and red and blue hats, that started with the filmmaker Spike Lee, who in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, went to New Era and wanted something with a little individuality, and it exploded from there. So, you know, the fans have an array of stuff to choose for, but once it's on the field of play, then it becomes a little bit of a different thing, And I will say also, Ron, that I think that, you know, I say this all the time, certain teams have license to experiment. If you are the Yankees or the Detroit Tigers, for instance, or the St. Louis Cardinals, you know, you got to stick to the script, and the dynamics are a little bit different from being the Marlins, Rays, or Diamondbacks.
Now they are called uniforms, so which leads me to believe that they should basically all look the same. But I don't know when this started, the pajama bottoms. I don't know when that started, and I'm not sure if some have stirrups underneath to bind them underneath the shoe. But I do notice that more and more players seem to be going back to the traditional knicker look. And I'm just wondering if that's a style thing, a functional thing, combination, total BS on my part.
Yeah, I mean, No. It's these are, you know, this is a trend, and trends inevitably come and go. And of course, we think about what guys, you know, Willie Mays and the San Francisco, a couple of players in the San Francisco Giants in the late '60s were pulling their stirrups up. Frank Robinson also did it with the Orioles and with the Reds. Mm-hmm. You know, so that you just saw these two little strips of color that were probably, you know, a quarter to a half an inch wide. That was the style. Skin tight pants were the style. Things start to get a little bit baggier, a little bit sloppier. When you think about it, stirrups, of course, are, you know, they're pointless. They are, you know, sanitary socks, which really don't need to be sanitary or protect guys from getting spiked and dyes seeping into their wounds. You know, that dates back to the days of Ty Cobb, so there's really no reason to have anything other than a pair of socks. It's interesting because there are several organizations that require their players to wear their pants a certain length and to wear the socks a certain way. And if you think about it also, think about the Reds of the Big Red Machine era. I think Johnny Bench talked about, you know, they had to have their stirrups. It was always black shoes and these thick, short, stumpy stirrups. And I think he had said that he used to go out hunting with them during the winter because they were warm as toast. So, but I do think that to answer your question to some degree, also the we've lost a little something toward the south end of the uniform with a lack of color with those pajama pants, and to get that little bit of color back is a good thing.
Was there one section of the book you enjoyed more than the others?
I mean, I will say that I think that, you know, I am a child of the '70s, so kind of revisiting the look that made me fall in love with the optics of sports was very good. But I was really kind of like, I had to dig deep and do a lot of research and come up with some rationales for the earliest uniforms in the game. And I think one of the most interesting things that I found sort of reinforced what I already knew, and that was the fact that people have been opining about their uniforms, their team's uniforms, for, you know, really back to the origins of the professional game. So getting some of that stuff down and verifying that was really pretty interesting. You know, going down these rabbit holes of research, I love. And I know what I know, but to find out something maybe that you didn't know, it's always a great thing.
How'd you go about finding out about color from the earliest uniforms? Because obviously the pictures from those days are black and white.
Yeah, newspaper descriptions. I mean, some of the colors, you know, I've been doing a lot of discussions about this book right now, as you can imagine, and I keep coming back to the fact that, you know, in our contemporary world, you know, we think of anything before maybe the 1940s as a world of black and white. Certainly the 1860s, 70s, 80s, that's a black and white world. So to imagine these flamboyantly colored silk uniforms in some cases is really hard to reconcile. The descriptions from newspaper accounts contemporary to these uniforms really opened everything up, and to again, close your eyes and imagine this incredibly colorful world where it doesn't exist in our minds. it was pretty instructive.
Right. I mean, when you're young and you're watching a black and white film, you can't imagine that what you're seeing is black and white, but when they were shooting this thing, obviously everything was in color.
Yeah. Again, and you know, there comes a certain point that's like, you know, it just opens everything up, and you know, I did read something very recently about with photo technology, really advanced filtering and stuff like that. People are recoloring photographs and interpreting speeches, stringing together pieces of the speech that JFK would have made had he made it to Fort Worth, and not having been assassinated in Dallas. Cool. So is it reinventing history? I mean, we had this conversation 20, 25 years ago when Ted Turner's network started colorizing movies.
Right.
It's an interesting thing to imagine and not be too literal about, is the way I think about it.
Well, that's the multiverse theory, isn't it? Like, something is always happening in every possible option everywhere at the same time. So Kennedy's still alive someplace making that speech.
yes. Conspiracy theories, too. Tupac Shakur is on that same desert island.
There you go.
And, just dig deep.
So do you have a favorite uniform?
Wow, that's interesting. I am a traditionalist, and I believe you said that you were as well. And I think, the beauty of I could rhapsodize about the beauty of the Dodgers uniform, mm-hmm. especially the home uniform, which is just a thing of harmony and perfection and balance, and the Cardinals and the traditions behind, the Tigers, the Yankees, and the Red Sox. But, some of the glorious disasters, as I call them, the dumpster fires that are in here, there's some glory that needs to go to the risk takers as well here and there. So while I might be a traditionalist at heart, I have a great deal of admiration for the chutzpah of whoever came up with some of these things, and we do know the names. And I think you said it before, progress is inevitable. It's a good thing, and you've got to appeal to youth and to generations. So, it's a multifaceted answer, but there you go.
Well, that's another interesting point. You say you have to appeal to the fans. When clubs design their new uniforms, do they say what they want to appeal to the fans? I know a while back, this is going back to the skin tight uniforms, they maybe perhaps were appealing to the ladies in the audience.
Yeah, I think there was a certain amount of athlete vanity also in that case. But I think that, when it comes to imparting a new brand onto a professional team, you should be thinking long term. Now, what's long term in by our standards today? Is it 3? Is it 5 years? Mm-hmm. Something like that. I mean, you'd like to think it would be longer than that, but who knows what the future is going to look like? Whereas I think we probably could have a better understanding of this. We did have a better understanding of this. I could say this professionally 5-10 years ago. Now everything's kind of thrown out the window. So I think that, you make a change with longevity in mind. There's a lot of testing and focus testing and, discussions with groups and stakeholders. And, again, hearkening back to something that I said earlier, these things need to work. Form and function need to come together. And there are so many stakeholders who do have a stake in the success of what these things look like. How does this look on broadcast? How does it translate into somebody who, needs to embroider something or stamp it into metal? And how does it look as a little Twitter avatar? All of this stuff. It's a very holistic approach that needs to be taken, so it should be done with care.
And we've been talking with Todd Radom, author of Winning Ugly, A Visual History of the Most Bizarre Baseball Uniforms Ever Worn, published by Sports Publishing. Todd, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Ron, it's been a pleasure. Some great questions, and I appreciate you having me.
And that was our conversation with Todd Radom. Check the website often to see when the next Bookshelf Conversation goes up. I wish I could tell you who it would be and when it will be, but unfortunately, que sera sera, what will be. In the meantime, visit the website, Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com, for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews about our favorite pastime. If you have any questions or comments, please drop me a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everyone. So long, and have a good summer. If old man Columbus had sat in the stand, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land."